can't avoid the Book of Neighbors.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
And here we are. This is the Interpreter Show. I'm Martin Tanner in studio with Terry Hutchinson, and we also have John Gee, Egyptologist, and we're here to talk about things that might be of interest to you. So hopefully you will stay tuned for the next 2 hours. We actually have, surprise, surprise, working phone numbers. So if you'd like to join us this evening and call us on the carpet about something or agree or bring up another subject or whatever's on your mind, as long as it passes FCC muster, which is frankly a very low threshold, and it deals with religion, we will entertain your call, at least for a while.
But please keep your language clean.
That's exactly right. And the number to dial us up at is 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. So we hope you'll give us a call.
I think the first thing that I'd like to talk about, because I had to work yesterday, and I missed the Temple on Mount Zion seminar that occurred yesterday down at Brigham Young University. And John actually gave a presentation. I'm not going to ask him to give his presentation, although I am going to ask him to email it to me.
So no full presentation.
That's
tonight,
right. No full presentation.
Yeah.
Tonight.
So give us a synopsis. You know, actually, that is a great place to start, because we will have listeners tonight who know quite a bit about that, but probably very little. So, John, why don't you start us off with what is this whole series of seminars, just kind of in a nutshell, and then what happened at the one yesterday?
Okay. I'm happy to talk about that. So these seminars were started by the late Matthew Brown, and he was always interested in the temple. He wrote a number of books on the temple, and temple symbolism and other things. And so he'd set up a conference and called it Temple on Mount Zion. He's got all these scholars together, and he'd asked me to speak at that one. And this was a few years back. And I said, yes, I'll do it. I had a topic and everything. And then the next week, he passed away. He had some sort of heart attack in the library.
Which was tragic.
It was very tragic.
Very young man.
He was training at Nottingham. So yes. It was really sad. And a couple of people picked up, notably Stephen Ricks, picked up the conference and carried it through. And with the people that he'd asked to do, they did the conference anyway. Some other people ran it. And then they have continued on doing these conferences every couple of years on temple themes. And so yesterday, just to give you a brief overview of the sessions, Kent Brown talked about Jesus' first visit to the temple, what it would have been like, based on ancient sources. Carrie Milstein talked about the role of sacred time in the Egyptian temples. Then you had Tom Weymouth discussing the early Christian supplanting of the temple with the body of a Christian, that their bodies were to be temples of God. Matt Bowen talked about Levi and Levites and how the root on which the name Levi is based is used in temple symbolism, as well as the Levites being priests. Jeff Bradshaw talked about Moses 1 and how that fits in with the temple. And then you had a lunch break, and Ryan Davis, BYU Ancient Scripture, talked about what it was like to give thanks and bear testimony in Hebrew and how that compares and contrasts with LDS testimony meetings, and some insights that can be got that way. John Thompson talked about the two ways in ancient Egyptian religion, but we usually think of the two ways being the way of life and the way of death, and he was talking about how on the in processions, particularly funerary processions, they would first go to one path and then go to another, so it's a different sort of two ways. Avram Shannon talked about consecration in rabbinic Judaism and then drew some parallels from that. Stephen Smoot had an excellent presentation on the symbolism of cupped hands in both ancient Egypt and in ancient Israel. Parallel artifacts, so all of these incense burners that you find some in Israel and a lot of them in ancient Egypt, where the incense burner is actually shaped like a hand that, around a cup. Then I spoke on the significance of when people are depicted wearing bare feet and when wearing shoes in temples. It was a largely pictorial thing, so I'm not sure how that really helps.
I seem to remember that from the last one, too, John.
Yeah.
And then Matt Roper finally talked about early Latter-day Saint accounts of temple clothing and how many people had visions of these before they went through the temple. They just noticed that and experienced the temple or before there was even Latter-day Saint temples, and they would describe the clothing, and then later they said, oh, I finally figured out what that was that I saw these angels wearing. So it was a very good conference, very informative, and some really amazing speakers. For me, it was interesting because Kent Brown was one of my professors. I've worked with Matt Roper and Carrie Milstein and John Thompson and Tom Waymont quite a bit. And then with the exception of Jeffrey Bradshaw, the rest of them were my students or former students. So that was... it's nice to see what they've done with themselves.
I think this is where we cue sunrise, sunset, or something
yes.
like that for but, John. But now Kent Brown also did the BYU New Testament commentary on Luke. And did he take it from that?
He took some of it from that, and he also talked about a little bit about how he's doing the New Testament commentary on Ephesus. And he was a missionary in Izmir, and... ancient name of that is Smyrna, but it's in Turkey, and it was a half-hour drive from Ephesus, and he often would go there, mm-hmm. have occasion to go there. So he spent a lot of time in Ephesus on this mission that he just finished a few years ago. So he's doing the commentary.
Our neighbor in St. George, who's now an area authority, was the mission president there for a while, and... that was just a few years ago that he's been back, Mike Wilstead, so maybe they served together.
It actually was under, I think, Jim Toronto.
Okay.
Who is now back teaching at BYU, a fantastic Arabist and great historian.
So that, you know, that was... They will be publishing that, I presume,
yes.
pretty soon.
And they did get it filmed.
Oh, I saw that email.
And recorded, yeah.
They got it filmed and recorded. I learned some things about filming equipment from the people who are doing it, but it was, so that will be available, I don't know exactly when, but that will be on the interpreter website.
Well, I'm glad that worked out well. That's wonderful. And it's always a great conference. There has never been a single time where I've talked to someone who has attended who has said, you know, this one was kind of a dud. It's just not even a single time. So the level of scholarship and presentations are just very, very high.
It's good. It's a little exceptional for an academic conference that way, because oftentimes, usually with an academic conference, you get one or two turkeys. sometimes you get more than that. And
is that
don't.
Why they do that in Geneva, so that if you have a turkey, at least you're in Geneva?
There you go. And why it's close to Thanksgiving.
No, the conference I was in last time, and I did some research in Geneva, but the conference was actually in Turin, Italy.
Oh.
And it was a better than normal conference. And
nice.
It was all on Daryl Medina, which is the ancient workman's village. These are the people who carved out the tombs and decorated the tombs of the Valley of the Kings. And it's unusual because we have the archaeological, we have the houses they lived in, we have the tombs where they were buried in, we have their work site in the Valley of the Kings, and we have lots and lots of records that they left, because what they had lots of out of digging out of the limestone, the Valley of the Kings, or limestone chips, and they would write on those. And that's a little more durable than papyrus. And so we have about 500 years worth of records from that period. The site is unique in the ancient world.
You know, I was driving this past week, and I heard something that most people would consider totally out of the blue, and it was something along the lines of, and of course, not wanting to cause a wreck on the freeway, I did not swing off to the side and try to, you know, write this down or jot it on a napkin or something. But the gist of it was new archaeological discoveries in the Valley of the
Kings.
About
the ramp.
Yeah. And
it was about the ramp, yeah.
And they talked about new mummified cats and other. It was just a really unusual newscast. What? Is that anything that you
I've actually
noted?
Missed that discovery.
You know,
I haven't followed up on it, but
this would be the first time in the history of the world that I might have heard about something maybe that John hasn't heard of. Like.
Especially about Egypt.
But
I heard about it too, Marty, so
right.
It's not like it's just made up.
There
mummified cats are actually known from that time period. I was from that area, Valley of the Kings and in the Luxor area. I've been doing a lot of research on the early exploration there, and they actually did find a huge, they found a fair number of mummified animals, cats, ibises, and so forth, and they're not exactly sure where they were originally found, but there were a number of them that were found and made their way into museums in Europe, and so it wouldn't surprise me that they would find that there. Most of our examples of those sorts of mummified animals actually come from Saqqara, which is in the area of Cairo, instead of down in Luxor, but they did have them in Luxor. We do know about that, and then they have mummified bulls down at Hermonthis.
Wow, that would take serious effort, because bulls are not small creatures. But shifting gears,
yeah.
let's talk about the new volume in the Joseph Smith papers series. And gentlemen, why don't you give us an overview of what you know, or
I can start a little bit, because I've actually talked about it on the air, and John, from what I understand, is doing something a little more in depth for a publication. But my experience with it as a layperson is that it is a bit different than the one that Farnes did, now the Maxwell Institute, several years ago, that I believe John was partly involved in with that one. And the main differences in this has all of the papyri.
Oh.
We'll talk about this after the break.
Apparently we will. The breaks wait for no one. We'll be right back. This is the Interpreter Show on KTalk Media. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Shut up.
are back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. Before we go any further, we should mention that the Interpreter Foundation is a nonprofit foundation formed by scholars in the Restored Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and Dan Peterson is the current chairperson. It's a nonprofit, so there's not a board of directors. There are trustees, but this is a fabulous organization. You can find it online at Mormon Interpreter, and has some great things. If you have questions or issues that you would like to read about, take a look at Mormon Interpreter. And if there's anything you would like Mormon Interpreter to tackle, feel free to make a suggestion. All kinds of things on the website, and I will give you a sneak preview of a project underway, which is, of course, the Come Follow Me is the new study program for youth and adults in the church, and there'll be a new series of roundtables for the Come Follow Me curriculum. So look forward to that. And with that brief introduction to the Interpreter Foundation, I'll again welcome John Gee and Terry Hutchinson into our studios today. They're regulars here on the Interpreter Show. Tonight we're talking about, so far,
we're not talking about that anymore.
The temple on Mount Zion, which we are, I am now informed, we are done with that. We are completely done with that. As a matter of fact,
no, it was the cats.
I can tell that if we get a caller on the temple on Mount Zion, you can talk about anything but mummified cats. And if you would, and if you want to join us on any other subject, we'll entertain that. We ought to talk, though, about what we brought up right before the break, and that is the new Joseph Smith Papers publication, which is Volume 4 in the Documents and Translation series, which deals with the...
Revelations, facsimile edition. Yes. And, so that's a different thing.
And this is the one on the Book of Book of Abraham.
So on the Book of Abraham and all of the Abraham-related papers, I believe.
Correct.
And that's where it's a bit different than the ones that Farms did back in 2010. Back in 2010, Farms, actually before that, I think 2001 was when they did the first volume. They did five volumes in what they called Studies in the Book of Abraham. And the first one had to do with early traditions about, or traditions, excuse me, about the early life of Abraham from many different backgrounds and traditions, including many that had never been translated before into English. There were two volumes having to do with some of the Joseph Smith papyri that were just regular translations from the Egyptian, one of them being from the Books of Breathing and the other one from the one of the Books of the Dead. And then there was a volume containing some essays. And then the fifth volume was actually a facsimile edition or a textual history of the Book of Abraham manuscripts in some of the editions. What the Joseph Smith Papers has done here in their facsimile edition is they've taken all of that and they've photographed it and given us transcriptions like they did with the printer's manuscript for the Book of Mormon that they did about 3 years ago. And that volume got a lot of attention because it had the first pictures of the seer stones that were among the items that Joseph Smith used to translate the Book of Mormon. And then the first one was the Book of Revelations, the Revelation book. I'm not sure, I don't recall the technical term exactly. So this is one of those larger editions. It's not a, it's not one of the regular volumes of the Joseph Smith Papers Project. Now, the Joseph Smith Papers Project's been around for 10 years now, and they release two volumes a year, usually a little bit after conference. I don't know why they don't do it before, but that's their schedule, and they're sticking to it.
Because they're all scholars and not marketers.
Well, anyway, they don't really have to market this one very much. I'm sure there's some marketing involved. But your typical, in my experience on my book program that I do every day in St. George, the typical experience for a papers or a documentary volume like that, say for George Washington or for Alexander Hamilton, you might get 1,500 people to buy it. The first edition and the first volume of the Joseph Smith Papers sold over 10,000 copies. And that is an extremely large number, and I believe they are still selling. Many members of the church get them. And it takes a while to adjust from reading a narrative history like Saints, which we talked about, you know, the last couple of months, and then one of these documentary volumes where you're actually looking at a picture of the document, you're looking at a transcription of the document, there's bibliographical information in it, there's some footnotes that try and help you understand the context of what you're looking at. And so each one of these is a bit different. And then the facsimile editions are even more so because they have the photographs. So what we have is we have a photograph. It's high resolution, high quality, and then they provide a transcription of what you're seeing exactly as it appears on the paper. At least, these are the theories behind it. And so each one of these is edited by a different group of people or you know, some different editors, all under the umbrella of the general editors. And then they meet the standards for the National Archivists. And they're going to continue. I think we've got at least four or five more document volumes. And I don't know. I presume we're going to have at least one more facsimile edition, hopefully for the Joseph Smith translation, is what I think. I don't know if anybody can tell me any different here in this room.
Not in this room.
But anyway, this also has some of the other papers that are involved where Joseph and some of the other members who were with him, some of the early brethren, were attempting to learn to translate Egyptian, and they wrote down some things. And thankfully, we've got John here to kind of set us straight on that. I have to confess that the Book of Abraham is something that I've done a lot of study on its internals, what I call its internals. In other words, how it matches up with the Apocalypse of Abraham or the Testament of Abraham or other Abrahamic literature. I've never really concerned myself as much with some of the externals. Okay, where did the mummies come from? What was Joseph Chandler's role in it? Not much other than he sold them to Joseph Smith and so forth. John had a book that came out last year that really helped enlighten me about those kind of things. But I'm curious to know how this volume compares with the one that Farms did, and then what are some of the things that we can learn from it?
This volume, maybe the better comparison would be the comparing this volume to the other volumes in the Joseph Smith Papers series. This one seems to be not of the same quality as the previous ones. Part of the problem is this is a facsimile edition, and when you talk about particulars on a facsimile edition, you're referring to pictures, which usually don't go over well over radio.
Yes.
So,
which is why we didn't talk about the bare feet and the it's like trying to listen on the radio to somebody calling a table tennis tournament, you know, it's just really difficult.
Table tennis, partly because it goes on so fast. There are some people who are gifted at it. And they often are asked to do things like broadcast football games or basketball games. It's a skill that I've never learned, so I'm not going to try to do that. There are some disappointing problems with the latest volume, and it's hard to, without being able to show things, it's hard to describe those over the radio. So readers should probably lower their expectations a little bit on this volume about what they're going to get out of it. The pictures are in general superb, and so that is a great testament to the production values of the series. The paper, the binding are all what you'd expect out of a Joseph Smith Papers volume. But there are, I've noticed a few errors in some of the transcriptions, and there are some other errors in the volume, and we'll leave that at that.
Well, yeah, I know that you're preparing something for publication.
Yeah, and we'll leave it at that. And so, mm-hmm. How does it differ from the earlier textual history of the Book of Abraham? Well, with the textual history, part of the it was a publication of some of the same documents. It did have the color photographs and the black and white photographs and the transcriptions, and I understand that one of the people who was involved in both projects was less than satisfied with his first attempt, and I hope he's a little more satisfied with the second attempt. And so there are some things that are in the first volume that aren't in the second volume, and then there are some things in the second one in version that aren't in the first. So I'm not sure that either one will supplant the other.
In the big picture, though, how can our listeners benefit from this volume? Granted, it's got some issues, but how can someone like me, who's a knowledgeable reader, who's fairly well read, what are some things I can take from this volume as I look at it?
I think part of it depends on what you're looking for. There are certain things that you can look for. Obviously, the photography and the pictures are really good. When it gets to the actual papyri, the pictures tend to be good, but there are problems with fragment placement. Maybe it's just because I'm a specialist in this area, and we get pretty particular about, yes, these pieces actually go together right this way, and that isn't the case there. If you're looking for fragment placement, Michael Rhodes's volumes on the papyri are actually mm-hmm. better.
And that's in the Farm series.
Right, that's in the Farm series.
Two
but,
and four.
But the difference is, of course, that Rhodes had training in Egyptology and mm-hmm. the current editors do not.
So let's step back for a minute and just talk about the contents of what people will find in here, because we've been sort of talking about quality and this and that and the other. But if somebody is saying, I wonder if I want to look at this, just – What would be a survey of the contents?
The contents of the papers volume, it has the papyri that we currently have that were once in Joseph Smith's possession. It has all of the manuscripts from whatever source that people have attributed to having some process dealing with
The Book of Abraham. The
translation of the Book of Abraham. It's the first official publication of any of these documents. And there are sometimes problems with editio princeps, and so those tend to apply here. That's a technical term meaning the first publication of an ancient document. So they have copies of characters that people made in the 1830s and 40s. They have any document that somebody has attributed to the translation of the Book of Abraham, whoever's handwriting it is in. But people ought to know that every aspect of these documents is disputed. Their authorship, the provenance is not, but the document, the authorship is disputed, the intent, what the document actually is, what it tells us, all of that is disputed. So somebody who's using this can form their own opinion based on what they can see in the documents and what they can try to make out of the documents. So the advantage of this is it lets you play on your own with the originals, which you with good photographs, which hasn't been the case in the past. There's only been a few people who've actually had access to these, and they've often made claims that, well, at least are debatable.
And so now it's all out there.
It's all out there. There is an issue of, on many of these documents whether they even belong in the Joseph Smith papers.
Because they may not have been done by Joseph Smith
they
or
may not
even
have
under
been,
his direction.
Or they may not have even, they may not be under his direction. They may not have even been in his possession.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is disputed. So,
but at the very least, everything is here for someone to look at.
People have it, and it's a good first stab. There are a number of problems that hopefully, as time goes on, will be at least identified that so people can
know. Be corrected with errata or in actually even a new edition.
Yeah.
And that happens with a lot of documents, Dead Sea Scrolls or Nag Hammadi.
Yeah, the Dead Sea Scrolls are multiple editions. Nag Hammadi, you have multiple editions. There are, it's not unusual for something like this, and particularly when there is any sort of controversy around the document, then sometimes they end up having multiple editions and corrections.
Stay tuned. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. John Guy, Terry Hutchinson, and Martin Tanner in studio. We'll be right back after this. We are back. If you are just joining us, this is the Interpreter Show right here on KTalk Media. If you'd like to join us, you have somebody who is very knowledgeable about Egyptology. John Guy is in studio today. Dr. Guy has a PhD in Egyptology from Yale University. If you'd like to ask a question about the Book of Abraham, he's probably the guy that you might want to do that with. And so feel free to give us a call. The phone number is 801-254-1640. The Interpreter Show is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which is a group of scholars that does scholarly research on Latter-day Saint subjects of all kinds, including defending the faith. So take a look at the website, MormonInterpreter.com.
They've got all of the articles ever done, and they release at least one article every week and have for... What, 10 years now?
No, not 10. It's
eight?
Started in 2012, so it's been
okay for
six consecutive years,
mm-hmm.
every week. And
they're peer-reviewed articles, and
yes.
It's very impressive, and they cover a wide range and variety of subjects. That kind of reminded me, as I'm getting ready for my program, which is every day on the radio in St. George for books, I've been putting together my religious book of the year selection for next month. I put together a Christmas list, and some of the wish lists that we've got coming pretty soon, we've got a couple of them already. One of those that I was waiting for was We'll Sing and We'll Shout, the biography of William W. Phelps, and one of the chapters in that book that was fairly interesting to me was how much he was involved in the Book of Abraham.
An immense amount.
And so that's one of the questions involving with the Book of Abraham papers is, well, what's Joseph's, what's Phelps, what's, you know.
And you're right, that is one of the questions, and it's not agreed upon. Even the scholars argue back and forth, and there are people who would like to give W.W. Phelps a greater share of the credit, I guess, or mm-hmm. the blame for some of those things. And there are some who insist, no, this is all Joseph Smith. And you have the problem. So if you find something, W.W. Phelps served as a scribe for Joseph Smith. If you find something in his hand when he was in Kirtland, does that mean that he's acting as a scribe? And there are some people who would say, well, yes, of course, that he's acting as a scribe. Well, does that include his letters to his wife? And W.W. Phelps, if you know anything about it, he was a newspaper man. He was extremely prolific.
And he was well-educated for being on the frontier.
Yeah, he was very well-educated, knew a few languages, and liked to show off his languages. Very interested in that sort of thing. Very independent thinker. wrote several of the hymns. The 1835 hymnal was put together by Emma Smith and W.W. Phelps. And W.W. Phelps wrote a bunch of the hymns mm-hmm. for it, including, yeah. I think, The Spirit of God.
The Spirit of God, which actually there are two verses not in our hymnal that were sung at the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. Fascinating, by the way.
And I think, and he wrote sacrament hymns. He wrote Praise to the Man, and, mm-hmm. and one that was inspired by his work on the Book of Abraham, If You Could Hide a Kolob. And all of those, he is his own, and he wrote lots of editorials. So he was a prolific author in his own right. And so you have to ask yourself, when you've got something in his hand, and when is this Joseph Smith and when is this W.W. Phelps?
Yeah.
That's at least a question you have to ask. And Phelps is an extremely fascinating individual. He was disaffected for about a year.
Was excommunicated 3 times.
Yeah. Well, he actually testified. Joseph Smith ended up in Liberty Jail on W.W. Phelps' testimony.
Yes.
And then about a year later, when Joseph's finally out of Liberty Jail, he writes a letter back to Joseph Smith and asks to be forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
And Joseph Smith writes back to him and doesn't mention, that he'd spent all that time in jail based on W.W. Phelps' false testimony.
He welcomes him back with a
welcome, and he says, come on, dear brother, since the war is past, we're friends at first, we're friends again at last. And it's that sort of treatment of Joseph Smith to W.W. Phelps that when Joseph Smith dies, Phelps writes Praise to the Man.
Yeah.
And because that's the Joseph Smith that W.W. Phelps knew.
Yeah. So that was one of them. Another one that I was looking forward to is one we talked about a month ago when I was here, but the physical book is now out and people can buy it. It's Martin Harris, An Uncompromising Witness to the Book of Mormon. It's by Susan Easton Black and Larry C. Porter, and it is a fascinating look, the first one in a long time, at one of the original three witnesses to the Book of Mormon.
One of the things that impressed me about Martin Harris is not only was he a witness to the Book of Mormon in that he saw the angel and saw the plates, but early on he picked it up, he lifted the box they were in, he'd hefted them, and he said, he's a New England farmer and used to this sort of thing. He said that he knew from the heft that the plates were either of lead or of gold, and he knew that Joseph Smith couldn't borrow enough to buy that much lead,
let alone gold.
Great comment. Well, I would even step back a little bit before that time and mention that in addition to his fabulous first name, Martin Harris, but Martin Harris, I think, is unfairly...
Careful or we'll attach you to the Tanner.
That's fine. That's right. Yeah, well, years ago I had a three-hour radio debate with Gerald and Sandra Tanner, and I introduced them as my thankfully very distant relatives. There was this silence for about 10 seconds, and then everybody burst out laughing. So it turned out all right. We have a caller, so let's take the call, and then I'll mention my comment about Martin Harris a bit later. Caller, you're on the air. Your first name and your question or comment.
Yes, I would like to talk about the Proposition 2 passing.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'm glad Proposition 2 passed because one good benefit of passing, it tells the good old boy white geezers on Temple Square that the people aren't going to listen to them. That tells them to sit down and shut up.
Well,
are we talking about Proposition 2?
He's talking about Proposition 2,
oh,
and then
well.
He's glad that it passed.
Well, you know what? The legislature's going to modify it anyway and make some appropriate changes
well,
to it, is what
I understand.
Well, the
legislature is a bunch of cowards, you know, a bunch of Mormon Nazi cowards. They should be voted out of office, too.
Well, thank you for your kind comments. I appreciate the call. I have a different point of view about Proposition 2, which I will mention here for a minute, and that is that we see from similar things being passed under false pretenses in different states, the same way it was done here, that people will lose their lives and all kinds of other problems will ensue. So,
if there's a medical benefit from it, that's okay. But the way that they passed it in Nevada, where I practice law, as well as in Colorado and in California, it was basically just another excuse to do something else with it that was not medically supervised. And therefore, I opposed it for that reason.
Well, and that's what happened here. You could already get a prescription in Utah for anything that was FDA approved medical marijuana. And so it was under a bogus and misleading name.
Well, one of the other books, though, that getting back to some of things for Christmas, Thomas Waymond, who appeared at the presentation yesterday, has a new translation of the New Testament coming out.
Actually, it is out. I've seen a copy. I haven't been able to look into it.
Mine is supposed to be there Friday, but I didn't get it.
It came out on Wednesday.
Ah.
And Tom's a friend. Mm-hmm. He was very excited. And it's impressive that somebody has gone through and done their own translation of the whole New Testament. You know, if the BYU New Testament commentary
has
doing
a rendition.
Does
each author do their own rendition? Is that the way that works? That's one thing about that series, which I'm very high on, by the way.
They each do their own translation, and they put it beside the King James so you can see the differences.
Yes.
A lot of them, I think most of the ones also include a Greek text that they're translating. If you're for those people, those handful of people who can actually read
Greek.
which I have my own little biases towards encouraging anybody who wants to learn it. It's something because this is an entire translation of the entire New Testament by one individual who's a Latter-day Saint and who controls the Greek fairly well. And so I'm looking forward to seeing.
I'm curious to see the other apparatus and the notes and everything else. In fact, I tried to get one to bring tonight. I guess we'll have to talk about it again next month. But that is on the Christmas list, if you will.
It's one I would, as I say, I've seen the book, but I've not actually had one
to open it
and take a look inside. But some of the he has tries to render it into a rather idiomatic English and understandable English translation, and he has the skills to keep it faithful to the original Greek. So High hopes for that volume. I love to actually see inside.
Speaking of translations, Robert Alter has finally finished his Hebrew Bible translations. And I don't know, you probably have your own opinions about those that have come out already.
Robert Alter was a professor of mine at UC Berkeley. I took his class. And he's a great person, and he has a real sensitivity to both the Hebrew and to the English.
He has a bit of a humanist take to it, though, doesn't he?
Well,
on his commentary?
He does. It was interesting being in his class because it became apparent that although almost all of his students believed the Bible, he didn't. Didn't believe it actually happened. For him, it was another novel, but he has... he treats it with respect.
Yes.
And he treats both the English language and the Hebrew with respect. Mm-hmm. And I have, and he is a very insightful reader of the text. And so I have lots of reasons to praise Robert Alter's work. Even if I disagree with him on a couple of small points.
Several of the volumes out in, like, the five books of Moses and then the histories and so forth that appear, and I kept waiting for the prophets, the major prophets and the smaller prophets, the lesser prophets, I should say. And apparently it's three volumes, about 3,200 pages, retails for $125. So those people who are looking for that, you can get it online for a lot less, but that is something to save your... make a Christmas wish list for. And then another one that I'm anxious for, and I've talked about this a couple of times on the program before, is the new volume in the BYU New Testament commentary, and that's the one on Mark by Julie Smith.
And I haven't heard when exactly that one is coming out.
They said actually in the summer, and then it keeps getting postponed. I'm hoping it'll be before Christmas, but I think
they're shooting for that. I don't know if it'll succeed.
Hopefully before the second coming. And yes. This is the Interpreter Show. John D. in studio, Cherry Hutchinson, and I'm Martin Tanner. We'll be back on the other side of the news. Stay tuned.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show, which airs each Sunday night from 7 until 9 p.m. We invite you to give us a call and join in the conversation. If you'd like to do that, the call-in number is 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. This program is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which is a group of LDS scholars that does apologetics, which means defend the faith, not apologize for anything. It is comprised of scholars who do religious scholarship, and there have been a number of publications, as Terry Hutchinson, who's in studio, mentioned. The Interpreter Foundation has published at least one new publication each week since its founding, which is quite a remarkable track record. In studio today, Professor Dr. John Gee, who has a PhD in Egyptology from Yale University. So if you have a question or comment about the Book of Abraham, tonight would be a good night for you to call in. And Terry Hutchinson is in studio, who's been a radio talk show host for decades, and since he was seven, since he's not that old, right? And I'm Martin Tanner in studio, playing with the microphones and the boards here to try to disrupt things whenever I can for a minute or two here. So we've been talking about books and reads and different things. Before we do that, let's take a call and see what our caller has in mind. You are on the air, your question or comment.
Caller, you're on the air.
Well, let's try another caller. Hi, you are on the air. Your question or comment?
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. First of all, I didn't get the name of the new New Testament that just came out Wednesday.
It's written by Thomas Waymond, BYU professor of New Testament.
Thomas Waymond?
Thomas Waymond, W-A-Y-M-E-N-T. And it's published by the Religious Studies Center, and you can probably order it through them. I haven't seen it on any of the major online online, but you can go to the Religious Studies Center or call them, and you can get a copy of it there.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you. I'm interested in that. And I actually think there's three reasons why. I mean, of course, I agree with that we believe in the scriptures, you know, the Bible, as far as it's translated correctly. But I believe that there's two other reasons, and that is one.
Two other reasons for what, sir?
A lot of the scriptures, I think we just don't have enough information. And so there's a problem in either understanding what's being conveyed, you know, or, you know, especially the idiosyncrasies and the, you know, of different cultures. I just think in a lot of circumstances, maybe even the majority of circumstances in the scriptures, the Bible, we just don't have enough information. And so, you know, we have what's there, but if someone's translating partial information into another language, there's a lot of difficulties.
There are a number of difficulties with translations, and so there are a number of difficulties, as you pointed out, in that make it difficult for us to understand the scriptures. Sometimes the translation can be an issue. For example, in the King James Version, the term prevent meant to come before. And so there's a passage where it says the saints won't prevent us from joining Christ. And we think that means that they're going to somehow hold us back, and really it means that they're not going to get there before we do. Those are some examples that there's been some changes in the way the language is used. There are cultural differences, things that we often don't understand. I did an article once on the Lord's hand being stretched out for us. We take that as a sign of mercy, but the ancient Hebrews did not. That was a sign of punishment.
A sign of what?
Of punishment.
Oh.
The hand stretched out actually means lifted up and above your head, and you have to imagine a sword or a club in the hand. That's when Isaiah talks about the Lord's hand being stretched out, and that's what he's describing. And we actually have iconographic examples that match that. So sometimes there are cultural differences like that, and so we could misunderstand scriptures that way. Nephi talks a lot about...
That's quite an opposite meaning.
Well, we take it opposite, but it's not that different of meaning. Nephi talks about how it was helpful to know about the countries round about, and we typically don't. For example, there's often mentions of Hamath in the Old Testament, and most of us couldn't find that on a map to save our life. And you need to know that it's a country that's north of Israel. They mentioned Pothros, and we don't know where that is. And so this sometimes gets in the way of our understanding the scriptures. There are a lot of impediments that way. There are a number of ways to overcome them. One of them is to be taught by the Spirit. And another one is that sometimes there are good scholarly resources available.
Mm-hmm.
There are also some bad ones, too.
Yeah.
But that's always the struggle, is to try and understand, one, what's being conveyed, and then, two, what would God have you learn from it? And that's harder to get a scholar to tell you, right?
A lot of the problems that John has just mentioned that we find with the King James translation are taken care of, at least to the extent that we're able to, with some good new modern translations like the New Revised Standard Version. But if you go to the Old Testament, you will find that page after page after page, you'll find some little footnote, and it will go down to the bottom, and it will say Hebrew unknown or Hebrew obscure, or, you know, give you several different possibilities for the rendition of a specific word. So to your point, caller, there are lots of archaic words that have come down to us from the Old Testament that even the best and the brightest of today's scholars just really are unsure of the meaning.
A couple of resources that I've found for somebody that wants to improve or up their game when it comes to learning about context or learning about background. One of them is fairly new. The second edition came out last year. I talked about it a month ago. It's called the Jewish Annotated New Testament. And so it is at the New Revised Standard Translation, which is the general scholarly translation that's accepted unless somebody basically does their own. And then it has a lot of material about Judaism of that time written by Jewish scholars. Now,
wow.
It's not perfect, and I'm sure that it's something that I don't agree with 100% of the time. But on the other hand, it is a great place for somebody such as yourself who's interested to start. Take a look at the footnotes, take a look at the essays written by these people who have Jewish backgrounds and who, you know, certainly don't recognize Jesus Christ in the same way that we as Christians do. But on the other hand, you get a sense for the type of culture that he and the apostles lived in at that time. Another one for the Old Testament is the Jewish Study Bible. Both of these are published by Oxford, by the way. Second edition came out in 2014, and it is a translation of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible from the Jewish Publication Society. Now, once again, you have the problems John mentioned with translations, but on the other hand, you can start to broaden your horizons from the King James Version, and that helps you formulate something that you can compare as you compare it with the Spirit, which also John mentioned.
And something else, another book that I would recommend if you're just interested in background, and this doesn't apply to specific books of the Bible, but the general background, and that's James K. Hoffmeyer's The Archaeology of the Bible. And he writes well. Well, Hoffmeyer's a friend,
I have several of his books.
He's a first-rate scholar. He is a practicing archaeologist. I think he just retired. But he is also a believing Christian. And he is able to weld those together and to explain it in an easy-to-understand fashion. You don't have to be a scholar to follow it. It's written for a non-specialist and is a good introduction to the whole Bible. He's a bit better on the Old Testament than the New Testament, but that's the area he works in. But his material is solid.
Wow, excellent. I got more than I bargained for.
You ask us about books, you'll get a fire hose.
Yes, wonderful. I did take notes, and I'm going to look into them. Thank you so much. And also the third reason, I think, here in the Doctrine and Covenants 1, we're all familiar with 24, where it reads, "Behold, I am God, and have spoken it. These commandments are of me, and were written, and were given unto my servants in their weakness," number one, "in their weakness, after the manner of their language," number two, "that they might come to understanding." So, you know, I think that all the scriptures, when a perfect God is working with fallen mankind in different cultures, he deals with them, you know, in their weakness, after the manner of their language and their understanding. And I think in DNC 1, that is one of the greatest clues in studying scriptures, you know, that when we think if there's inconsistencies in the Bible or about God or something, I mean, you know, they think, oh, wait, this looks like, in our limited understanding, we think this looks like an inconsistency, but when we think how God deals with fallen people, you know, according to their language, their understanding, that they might come to knowledge, to me that gives us a huge insight that we should be careful. I mean, because the main purpose of the scriptures, I think, is to, you know, lead us to God. And so, you know, come to our own personal relationship with God. And so, you know, it's sometimes that we can really get caught in a quagmire, you know, if we, instead of seeking our personal relationship, you know, we get caught up in all the different cultures and things we don't understand, and that can really stop us. It can really damn us, you know, stop us from having a relationship with God.
I think you're right. It's a great point that you're making, and it's one of my favorite scriptures that you cited there, and it does factor in. And sometimes I think I'm reminded of a quote that Joseph Smith once said. It says, "Never meddle with visions of beasts or things that you don't understand." And so I often think about this, and sometimes there's times when more work at it will help, and then times when we're just not in a position to have anything that we do help us get more insight out of it. But we appreciate your call.
Great comments. Thank you so much. And that frees up a line. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. Another comment that I have is that, well, I guess I don't. You know, it just was not meant to be. Or, we'll be right back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. John P., Terry Hutchinson, and Martin Tanner in studio. We'll be right back after this. Stay tuned.
I'm Terry Hutchinson. There we go. I'm Terry Hutchinson with Dr. John Gee and with Martin Tanner. We are here for Interpreter Radio tonight, and we're here every Sunday night, at least some group of us, for Interpreter Foundation. And feel free to call in at 1-801-254-1640 if you want to join the conversation, or we'll just continue to entertain ourselves. So one of the things about Interpreter Foundation, it's a nonprofit group of scholars, and we have a lot of presentations, and if you go to the website, you can see it. We have an article that is produced for free every week, and it's been going now since 2012, at least one article per week. You can buy bound volumes on Amazon if you want to, or you can just look at them for free. That's what it's for. We have books that we produce. We have seminars that we produce. We've done one on science and Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saint beliefs. We've done four now Temple on Mount Zion seminars, the last one being yesterday. And if you want to make a donation, and this isn't NPR where we're actually doing that, but it is a 501c3 corporation, so your donations will be tax deductible. So feel free to join us on our conversation. I believe we have a caller. Good evening, caller. You're on with Interpreter Radio.
Okay, so I believe it was last week there was a discussion regarding the manuscript, the Book of Abraham manuscript, the notes in the columns, and the relationship with the Egyptian alphabet and grammar.
You're talking about the Kirtland Egyptian papers.
And you know more about that than I do, but there is a question on it, so Todd, go ahead.
What is the question that you have?
He said there is a question, so maybe he doesn't know much about it, and he wants us to explain what that is.
Is that the case?
It was by a person named Mulestein at a BYU Egyptologist and the conference that was held where.
Well, caller, let me try this. Let me try this. The question that typically comes up, or at least one of the many, but probably most of all, is whether or not the translation in the Kirtland Egyptian papers was somehow obtained from these characters in the left column, or whether the translation happened first, or whether or not the characters were added later. Does that sound like something, or am I completely off base here for you? Because John can answer this question.
Well, I'm not. The only thing is that after having gone through what the conclusion was, that there wasn't a straight relationship between the characters on the papyri and those on the manuscript and those on the Egyptian alphabet and the grammar documents, which blew away certain of the anti-Mormon theories.
All right.
But I'm not sure that it explains what was done.
I think I can explain a little bit about this. So about 2 weeks ago, there was a conference up in the sponsored by the Joseph Smith Papers on translation Joseph Smith's translations. And Dr. Kerry Mulestein gave a paper there on the translations, and the way it's usually thought is that, the hypothesis that's put forward is that Joseph Smith produced these manuscripts that are sometimes called an alphabet and grammar, and that they gave him a key to translating Egyptian, and that he took the characters off the papyrus, put it through this alphabet and grammar, and came up with the Book of Abraham. And what Dr. Mulestein showed is that when you actually try doing that, it doesn't work, and the characters don't line up. And sometimes when you have, in the various documents, when you have the same definition, they have different characters in the margin. Sometimes when you have the same characters in the margins, you have different definitions. That this was never a consistent or coherent system, and that was the bulk of it is the notion that was what Joseph Smith thought he was doing doesn't seem to actually work with the manuscripts that are supposed to have done this. And I'd seen part of Dr. Mulestein's presentation, so I know something about it. We will have to wait until that gets published till you get the full import of what he had to say. It was a very limited conference. There only had a few seats. I couldn't actually get into it. And so as far as I can tell, that's what you're talking about, and that's yes, he did seem to refute a number of the standard arguments that are put forth. We will probably have to wait for his published version to really take a look at it. What I've seen of it, his work was solid.
Well, isn't it also true, John, that we have transcripts of the Book of Abraham that predate the
Kirtland alphabet.
Exactly, that have the characters in the margins. So that could not have been the basis for the Book of Abraham anyway?
Well, the dating of the documents is, of course, disputed, and the recent volume of the Joseph Smith Papers project went for rather wider time periods. It's sometime between July and November. while I disagree with a couple of those datings, in some cases I think actually fall outside those. But the problem is that if you start working with the dating of the documents and the dates that seem to suggest themselves by the other material in the Joseph Smith papers, then the documents seem to be produced out of order for that to have been the case. This is, again, one of those areas where more research will probably refine some of that material. And but that's one of the disputed aspects. But you have these documents need to be looked at very carefully before you make any quick snap decisions about what they actually say. And that's a caution that I'd put with anyone using the documents is that you may be surprised by what they actually tell you.
What documents?
The documents that are in the new Joseph Smith Revelations and Translations, Volume 4.
It's basically all of the papyri, all of the manuscripts that they've got, and as well as the Kirtland alphabet, many of which, as we pointed out earlier on the program, aren't necessarily tied to Joseph Smith, or it is disputed as to how closely they are tied to Joseph Smith. But in order to try and be thorough and to avoid any kind of arguments against transparency, I think the Papers Project has wisely included them so that people can make up their own minds.
Yeah.
So where did the Egyptian alphabet and grammar documents come from?
Well, that is one of the disputed aspects. The one thing we know about them is the provenance. They seem to have been brought west by W.W. Phelps. That's with the exception of one of the Book of Abraham manuscripts, which was acquired by Wilford Wood from the Bittemans in Illinois. So that's the only one that we know of that comes from Joseph Smith. But the rest of the documents seem to have been brought west by W.W. Phelps.
Well, one of the theories that faithful Latter-day Saints have is that after the Joseph Smith's translation of the Book of Abraham occurred, that was the effort of the brethren in Kirtland to try to somehow correspond the Egyptian characters with the transcript. Now, I don't know what John would think about that, but that's one of a number of different points of view that are out there.
There are a number of theories. If you're interested in an overview of the theories, there's a chapter in my book that came out a year ago. It's entitled An Introduction to the Book of Abraham. And there's a chapter that deals with Joseph Smith and the papyri and lays out some of the various translation theories that are out there. And so if you want to, and then I give my take on how these documents fit in or don't fit in. But if you want to see that, I'd refer you to that book.
It's a great book, by the way. I can toot John's horn a little more than he can. It's fabulous. It's easy for a layperson to get through as well. It's just superb.
But you can see the various theories in that, and so rather than spend the time on the air, I think having it in writing in front of you gives you the advantage of you can go back over it as many times as you want to make sure that you understand what the point that's being made.
Yeah. So there's evidence of what wasn't done, but how are we coming on the evidence of what was done?
Well, I've been asked to work on that, so I'm hoping that I will have something to the publisher who asked me to do that in the near future. But I'm at this point, there's a limited amount that we can say. We can probably say more than we think we can, but we also could say less than we hope we can.
I can tell you that from my experience, and I'm a little bit, let's just say, I don't worry too much about that one. My study of Abraham, as I've mentioned both on and off the air many times over the years, you wouldn't have heard it unless you're down in St. George, but is that there are a lot of internal evidences for the Book of Abraham and its provenance as an ancient document. And so for me, I don't worry too much about these things. Joseph Smith obviously translated it from heavenly sources. Exactly how that was, whether he had something in front of him or not, that's certainly something that may be up for grabs, if you will. But realistically, for me, the point is we don't know exactly how he did it, but what he did is certainly inspired.
And I actually, just as a, occasionally I muse about what would happen if somebody analyzed some Egyptologist normal translation with the microscope that they've examine Joseph Smith's, and how well would we fare?
Yeah. So I don't know. And as far as that goes, we have the same questions about the other documents that Joseph Smith produced, whether it's the Joseph Smith translation, whether it's the Book of Mormon or anything else. And at some point, it does become an actual matter of faith.
Joseph Smith, when he was asked about the translation of the Book of Mormon by his brother Hiram at a conference, said it's not given to for the world to know the translation particulars of the translation of the Book of Mormon. I think that's true of most of his translations.
Well, and a final comment, I'm not sure that if he had been given carte blanche to really discuss that, that he could really say much more than it was by the gift and power of God. I mean, when you have something given to you by God, what else can you really say about it? There's not too much additional information that you could really give.
And another interesting point is some of the people who are most interested in the process of the translation can't actually translate another language themselves. And so this is a process that they're unfamiliar with, even in the normal sense.
Yeah, it's a great, great point. Caller, thank you. Great questions. Have we covered everything?
I think so.
All righty. Great call, as always. Thanks for joining us. We had a caller off the air, John, and we're going to probably run into our break here, who asked about Isaiah 19:19. Which indicates that in that day there will be an altar to the Lord in the heart of Egypt and a monument to the Lord at its border. And he's wondering if...
Well, we know of two temples to the Lord in Egypt that have been found archaeologically, one at Leomtopolis, which is near Cairo, and the other at Elephantine on the southern border of Egypt. So these are both known to have had altars. We have...
These are Hebrew temples.
These are Hebrew temples, and one of them has been found archaeologically. They've found it in the documents. They've identified it on the site. It's actually rather dangerous to get to. I've seen it. But it's right... Archaeology have these big tells, so they just build city on top of city on top of city. Well, then sometimes people go back through and start carving away at processes, and it actually happens that there's a dugaway part and there's a cliff that's at least 30 feet right in the middle of the temple, and so we only have half of it, and the rest of it is gone, and there's a cliff off the edge, so you can't really visit it. But they do have, they have uncovered two temples. One of the Leontopolis was founded in the time of the Ptolemies, and the other one in the Persian period.
So would your take be that that is what Isaiah 19:19 is? We'll talk about that.
It can be a fulfillment of that. We'll see you on the other side of the break. We'll be right back.
when the weather's hot outside. Cool off with the splash of K-Talk Media, 1640 AM. Oh yeah, now that's refreshing.
Attention all authors. Page Publishing is looking for authors. Have you written a book and want to get it published? Page Publishing will get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, Apple iTunes, and other outlets. They handle all aspects of the publishing process for you. Printing, cover art, publicity, copyright, and editing. Call 800-501-3689 now for your free author submission kit. That's 800-501-3689 for your free author submission kit. Again, 800-501-3689.
Ready, set, sweat. Your Burlington store's loaded with all the latest workout gear at amazing savings. What's hot? Black, white, and pastels are totally on trend, as well as mesh, lattice, and lace-up details. Turn heads and tops with strappy backs and bottoms with cool prints and color blocking. Plus, choose from your favorite brand-name sneakers, wireless headphones, kettlebells, and more. Hurry into Burlington and save up to 65% off other retailers' prices every day. Burlington, style for everyone.
Hey Dave, let's tune into the Simply Senior radio show on K-Talk this Saturday. It's at 2 p.m. and it actually sounds really interesting and maybe we can learn something.
I love you, Barb, but I think I'll pass. Besides, it sounds more like geezer radio. I bet it's all about soft foods and spray-on hair. How old do you think I am?
Okay, Dave, let me ask you in a different way. Do you want to listen to a radio show for people who are smarter, wiser, and have more life experiences than everyone else? Yes or no?
On second thought, I'm in.
If you want to join us for the Simply Senior radio show, tune into K-Talk at 1640 a.m. every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. See you there, Slugger.
The Simply Senior radio show is a radio program for those people who are a little bit smarter, a little bit wiser, and have a ton more experience than anyone else.
As a small business owner, you make every dollar count. So what could you do with $10? Go to Vistaprint.com today and you'll get 500 high-quality custom business cards for only $9.99. That's less than 2 cents per card. And at Vistaprint, your satisfaction is absolutely guaranteed. So it's never been easier to turn 500 strangers into connections. Just visit Vistaprint.com and use promo code 4000 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 4000.
I don't mean to brag, kid, but I'm a pretty healthy guy. Running a growing business means I'm always running. Not many can keep up with me. But you know who can? Granger. When it comes to getting me the answers I need right when I need them, Granger moves just as fast as I do. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're a good running partner, because no matter what problem I have or question, Granger's got my back. Call clickgranger.com or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show, final segment of the evening. That means if you would like to join us with your question or comment, last chance tonight, 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. In studio, Terry Hutchinson, John Gee, Egyptologist, and me. I'm Martin Tanner, running the boards tonight. If we move on to another topic, we ought to do that after mentioning that this is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. Go to MormonInterpreter.com. Take a look at all of the great things on that website. It's very much worth your while.
One of the things that Dan Peterson, who's the current chairman, mentions is that everybody is, with a couple of exceptions for office staff, is a volunteer. We here at Interpreter Radio are volunteers. Those people who write and who edit and who peer review and who take care of all the other things, probably including, I believe, the accountant who does the 503 donations and tax deductibility, all of them are volunteers. We donate our time for the purposes of the foundation. and what it stands for. So it's a good work, and we encourage you to support it.
And let me just mention one of the projects that they're doing that if you would like to contribute money for, because this is one of those projects that really takes up money, is that they are putting together a film on the Book of Mormon witnesses. And this, when you start talking about making film stuff, then the cost can really add up. And if you would like to contribute to that, they would appreciate it.
And it's a fabulous project, something mm-hmm. that's well worthwhile.
We recently lost this past year, two of our experts, if you will, on the witnesses, Richard L. Anderson and Scott Fallring. And as we mentioned earlier on the program, we have a new book out on Martin Harris.
Now, fortunately, they did manage to film Richard Lloyd Anderson before he passed away.
That's what the witnesses said.
So it would be great to get that film out. So that if you're looking for tax shelters at the end of the year, consider Interpreter.
Mm-hmm. You know, the person who got me involved with Interpreter years ago was Jeff Bradshaw, who's one of our vice presidents, and he's been on a mission to Africa recently, and he's been a big contributor to Interpreter Foundation. He's written a couple of books, excellent commentaries on the Book of Moses and the beginnings of Genesis. I keep waiting for the rest, the Abraham saga, the Jacob saga, and the Joseph saga, not to put any pressure on Jeff, but I think he has some other projects going on at the moment. But one of the things that he did years ago was he wrote an article in the Maxwell Institute, their journal on the study of the Bible.
Studies in the Bible and Antiquity.
And Antiquity.
Currently on hiatus.
Is that why we haven't seen a new one?
Yes, okay. It's on hiatus right now.
Okay, too bad. I look for it every time I turn around. But I'm probably the only one that does. But anyway, he and Ronan Head wrote a book about Ezekiel and about some findings. And the latest volume of the Anchor Bible on Ezekiel, chapters 38 through 40, was just released from the Anchor Yale Bible Series. This is one of the most prestigious Bible commentaries in English. I think that'd be fair to say.
It's definitely the top one in America.
And the author is Stephen Cook. Now, this Ezekiel volume has a little bit of a history. The first two volumes were written by Moshe Greenberg, who died of cancer. Before he died, he asked his friend, Jacob Milgram, who has written a three-volume, 3,000-word commentary on Leviticus for the Anchor Bible Dictionary, or for the Anchor Bible Series, as well as numerous other things about Numbers. I mean, his publications are too many to enumerate. And he started to work on the Ezekiel project for this last 10 chapters because they do tie in with the ancient temple, they tie in with the heavenly temple, and they tie in with what's called the priestly documents and the holiness code from Leviticus. And then he died of cancer in 2010. So Mr. Cook, Professor Cook, Dr. Cook, I presume that's all of the above, has taken over this third volume. But he cites Jeff Bradshaw's article from the Maxwell Institute and also an expanded version on Jeff's website, which is called templethemes.net, 7 times. He's also cited John Lundquist one time, who's also another LDS scholar. It's fascinating to see how these works, while it doesn't really mean anything other than this is serious scholarship that is done, it is peer-reviewed, and it is used by other scholars at the top of the publication. So it's an important thing, and it's quite a credit to Jeff and Ronan and the work that they did. The article came out in 2012. The expanded one came out in 2013, and Jeff's obviously moved on to other projects. But the fact that it can be used in this context is a huge credit to him, as well as to the work that is done not just by him, but by Analogy Interpreter Foundation.
It shows that his work was considered good enough that serious scholars take it into account.
And yes, it is a great tribute to Jeff's erudition. He's one of these people who you wish you were as competent in as many fields as he is.
The fact that he can write what he does as fast as he does is amazing.
Yes. I wish I worked that fast. But it's some great work that's been done, and thank you for highlighting that.
Other publications we want to talk about in the last few minutes of our program here. We have about 10 minutes left.
One of the publications I'm looking forward to is coming out this week from Eisenbrown's. Is the textbook of Idumean Ostraca, textbook of Aramaic Ostraca from Idumea, Volume 3, by Bezalel Portin and the late Adar Yordani. This is a project for publishing Aramaic Ostraca that were found in southern Israel, and they're Persian period. And until they started coming out, we had almost nothing from the Persian period Judea. And now we have over 1,000 texts that have been published, and it's all come out in the last 5 years. Amazing material, rich, and Bezalel Portin is very systematic about it. So
we should step back for just a second, because I'm sure there are people listening who are ostracized. What?
Okay.
Please define that for our audience, because that's...
I work with them all the time. So
that's
an ostracon is a text that is written on a potsherd. The ancient Greek word for potsherd is ostracon.
And people wonder, why would that happen? Well, today we have extra sheets of paper that we write stuff on. Well, back then
paper is cheap.
That's
so,
right. Back then they had chunks of things that broke.
Broken dishware is a lot more cheaper and easier to find than papyrus.
Back then.
Papyrus got quite expensive. They reused it a lot. Ostraca, they kept tax receipts on them. They kept all kinds of things. Some of these documents are letters. Most of them seem to be tax receipts, but...
And it did make audits really painful.
That's right.
Yeah. Well,
More paper cuts. You have pottery cuts.
Can be nasty. So it's like we're working with your shattered china, right? Anyway, these documents, so they tell us a lot about Persian period Judea, which is an area which we hadn't known anything about before. So this is, for example, we have a prophet in the Old Testament who wrote during the Persian period. His name is Haggai. It turns out Haggai is a very common name in Persian period Judea. And so these shed light on some of those later biblical books like Malachi, Zechariah, Haggai, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, all of those later books in the Old Testament. And so I'm looking forward to that. And it's a niche field. You have to...
That one won't be under my Christmas tree. I'm sorry, John.
Elder Maxwell said you need to be careful lest people ooh and ah over a tax receipt and miss the important things. But they can be useful in other ways, and they tell us some important things about the Bible. So it's exciting that there's more coming out. Cool. And we tend to forget that every year there are new texts, ancient texts being published all the time.
I would point out that in the next couple of weeks we will see the drop of the new Hermeneia volume, two volumes on the Book of Jubilees by Vanderkamp, James Vanderkamp. He's been working on it, I believe, for close to 50 years.
He's another prolific author.
Yeah.
And so there, I think Terry will probably envy me. I'm going to
yes,
the Society of Biblical Literature.
Thank you, yes.
This,
and you're
this
actually
weekend.
Presenting.
And
I'm not too envious about that. I'm not at that level yet.
No, it's the book display. They
oh,
have
the
hundreds
book
of
Bookanalia. Yeah, no,
hundreds
I,
of
yeah.
hundreds of volumes and the new stuff that's come mm-hmm. out, and they all try to get it out for this weekend. So lots of
it's in Denver, isn't it?
It's
Denver,
in Denver.
Colorado.
It's close.
Yeah.
You could almost drive.
I could almost drive. Yes. Don't tempt me. You
so,
might see me there.
Yeah, you should go.
Yeah, if anybody wants to catch me, I'm presenting Saturday afternoon at SBL and Thursday afternoon at ASOR. That's the American Schools of Oriental Research, which is also in Denver. And unfortunately, I'm right before and right next door to Bezalel Porton's presentation where he's talking about his new volume.
Mm-hmm.
There's a constant flow of new information, new archaeology, new texts that are coming out, and it seems like every year there's a few more original texts that we need to go through. And occasionally they have some real gems.
You know, some people listening who have never read anything like this would wonder, why is this fascinating? Well, I'm sure for you, John, and for you, Terry, and for me, context makes so much difference for scriptures and for religion in general. And when documents like this come out, they help us understand the context in which things happened. You mentioned the prophet Haggai, and this kind of thing, apparently, although I'm certainly not familiar with it, would help us understand the context in which he lived and in which he prophesied.
It's in going back to the Joseph Smith Papers volume, some of the documents that they originally considered publishing are ones that we wouldn't find that interesting, like his bank books.
Yeah.
There you go. And that is it for us. Another Interpreter Radio Show. Thanks for listening. John Gee, Terry Hutchinson, and I'm Martin Tanner. Join us again next week.